Okay, this is the hour we're going to take your phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM with Robert Zimmerman, space historian. And back with you with Bob Zimmerman. We'll take your calls. Bob, but let's get back to the question about 40 years since we haven't been to the moon. Why do we stop?
Well, look, as I said, you have a big, bloated government space program that's really focused on providing pork for congressional districts and not building spaceships to get to other worlds. For example, right now, we actually, within the United States, we have a competition between private enterprise building these commercial rockets and spacecraft, and you've got a government-run space launch system being built by demand by Congress. The private companies were going to have all these different spaceships and rockets. The whole program itself, total, from start to finish, to get these rockets going and these spacecraft built, multiple spacecraft, is about $3 billion. The whole program, from start to finish. The Space Launch System, which is the government-designed and built NASA-run rocket, it costs $3 billion a year. It's going to launch maybe once every 4 years. It's going to take a decade to get its first manned flight launched. At that rate, each launch is going to cost something like anywhere from $11 to $14 billion, which means it can never really accomplish anything. It's too expensive. What'll happen, as happened with the shuttle and happened with the Apollo program, is that the cost is so high that when it finally comes time to try and accomplish anything with that particular government rocket, Congress balks. They cancel the program, and then they start all over again designing a new rocket at great expense. I'd much rather the government stop trying to design and build rockets. If they need to get into space, they hire private companies to do it for them, and then it's done fast, it's simple, it's much less expensive, and we get a lot more accomplished at that point. And once again, once you get these private companies competing in space, what they end up doing is selling the product, not just the government, but to others. And so there's money to be made. SpaceX, which is the big name, has the Falcon 9 rocket. That rocket didn't exist 6 years ago. Today, it's leading the world in the most launches in 2015. And they've launched more Falcon 9s this year than any other rocket by any other company or nation. And in the process, they've not only launched capsules to ISS to provide cargo supplies, but they've also started to test landing the first stage. Did you see the footage, George?
Oh, yeah, it was dramatic.
It was incredible.
I didn't think they would
recover their first stage so they can reuse it again and save a lot of money and therefore lower the cost to get into orbit. Today, they launched a commercial satellite, the first commercial built by a European company, but it was for a former Soviet province, Turkmenistan, so that they would have communications capability. And it was launched for that country, which normally could, in the past, couldn't have afforded it, but they could because SpaceX charges half the cost for a launch. And so in the long run, you get much greater innovation. The owner of SpaceX, Elon Musk, he's doing it because he wants to die on Mars. He wants to travel to Mars, and he's developing a spacecraft and a rocket that'll eventually give him that capability. At least that's in his mind. In the meantime, though, he's not stupid. He wants to make money, and he's making money. He's making money hands over fist. He's forced every other rocket company in the world they've been sitting on their hands for 40 years, not trying to innovate, not trying to lower costs. They are now scrambling desperately because they have rockets that are bloated and expensive to launch, and they can't compete with SpaceX. That's why all the business is going to him. And so they're now just scrambling to come up with new designs and new rockets. ULA, which is basically a partnership of Boeing and Lockheed, they have the Atlas V and the Delta rockets. Those are very expensive to launch. They've just announced last week that they're going to come up with a new rocket. They're calling it Vulcan, which will have reusability built into it, where they're going to try to recapture the engines from the first stage, which is the most expensive component, to try to lower their cost. They haven't done anything innovative like this in decades, but now they're faced, they're forced, they've got to do something. Similarly, the Europeans, they have the Ariane 5 rocket. It dominates, for decades, it dominated the launch market. But it was expensive. They never made a profit on it because it was basically pork. Government subsidies kept it going. Well, they're going to lose all their business. They can't compete. They can't do it for the price. And so Europe is scrambling right now to replace that rocket with something quickly replace it. It's going to take them years, that can compete with SpaceX. And their aerospace industry, their main company, Airbus, has told them that they're not going to build. They're basically the contract who built Ariane 5, the rocket they have now, but they did it under the designs of the government. Airbus has said, we ain't going to build it unless we design it and we control it so we can get the cost down. And European space agencies are going to have to say yes, or they're going to end up with a rocket that no one will buy. And that's what's happening right now. So why have we gone to the moon? It's because we haven't allowed free enterprise, private industry, and American citizens to follow their dreams where they want to go. We've had the government dictate terms. And I've said this to you before, George. I don't want to see a space program. I hate the term. I don't want a program. What I want is a robust, chaotic aerospace industry of many companies competing, each having their own goals and dreams in space. And then what you get is you get unlimited potential and possibilities.
Good point. Let's go to the phones now. Chris in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Chris, go ahead.
Hey, George and Robert. How y'all doing tonight?
Good. Thank you.
I was actually my first time calling in.
Great.
Glad to be on the show. Just wanted to make a few comments and then get Robert's theory on something.
Sure.
Of course, space exploration, I think, is where humans should be headed because we need to get out in the universe, for one. Also, I wondered if Robert had ever seen the site buildtheenterprise.org.
No, I'm not familiar with that. If I am, remind me. You might jog my memory.
Well, I had just found it a couple months ago, and an engineer had actually put together an actual Enterprise, the design that Star Trek actually uses, and used like nuclear energy and a few other things in there, ion engines, stuff like that. And he theorized that it would only take about $40 billion to build it. If you just wanted to take a look at that, I just want to throw that out there. But also wanted to get your comments on a theory I had about why the universe is still expanding.
Yeah.
According to, you know, quantum mechanics, when you observe particles, just the fact of observation changes the observation.
Yes.
And I wanted to throw a theory out there that, you know, according to that, you know, could the fact be that just by the fact that we are observing the universe is continuing to make it expand?
That's an interesting idea. It's very possible. I wouldn't tell you no. I think that the problem we've got is that we have very, very little data on the expansion of the universe. It's very important to understand that it's not that objects farther away from us are moving faster. It's that the space between them is expanding. And so they're embedded in space, and space itself is expanding. Why it's doing that, we don't know. That's the why, George. You know, that's philosophy.
That's right.
The amount of data we have about that expansion is very limited because we only have been able to see deeply into the universe sharply and clearly since Hubble was launched. And so Hubble's done a few of those ultra deep fields covering about three specks of dust, of sand, across the whole sky. That doesn't give you a very wide sampling of what's going on in the universe, per se. And so in order to even answer your question, we need to have more data. It is absolutely true that the observation changes the event. This is per Einstein and other physics, but whether that's changing the expansion of the universe itself, I can't answer because we just don't have enough information yet.
Robert, if you could talk to the universe gods, what would you ask them?
Why?
Yep.
Like the little kid. I think the universe, whatever created the universe, God, a giant turtle, whatever created the universe, it did an interesting thing for us as a species, just us. There might be other species that would just think about it from our perspective. The universe is not obvious. The basics of what the universe is made of, the solar system, for example, the Earth, the elements on Earth, the atmosphere, it's not something that you can just see and automatically understand. It requires us to dig a little to understand it. And I think that's wonderful because it forces us as a species to dig, to search, to dig underneath, look behind the black to see what's really there. And so when you first look at the planets, the first glance suggests that they orbit the Earth. And the sun orbits the Earth. Well, you dig a little bit and you find that that's not really the case. And the atmosphere and the elements, first glance, it's fire, energy, and it's water, liquid, and it's solid, earth, and it's gas, atmosphere. So there was only four elements, gas, water, sun. But you know what that really is? That's energy, and then solids, liquids, and gas. The elements that make up everything is hidden. We have to dig a little to get it. And so asking the great creator of a question, I think, is too easy. I think it's much better. Let's go find out what the universe is like that we live in and go from there.
Next up, we go to Greensboro, North Carolina, east of the Rockies. Hello, Ross. Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
George, you're a great man. Robert... you know, sometimes science is the enemy of truth. And the proof of that is in the pudding. We go back and forth. Don't eat this, don't eat that, eat this, eat that. I met scientists back at Grumman Aircraft Aerospace back in the 70s and 80s, especially the 80s. And I asked them, we had like a roundtable discussion, and I said, you know, guys, you are the pioneers. You built the LEM module. Why aren't we going back to the moon? And they looked at me like, gee, boy, you know, that's a good question. It was as if they were just trying to hang on to their jobs in the 80s before they merged with Northrop. And my theory, and it's just a theory, is that sometimes you can look right at the forest, but you can't see it. There's no reason on Earth that we shouldn't have gone back to the moon. We had the resources, we had the money, we had the talent. And my theory is that we were told to stay the hell away. We have millions of UFO sightings since 1947. We have stories of abductions. I myself saw a magnificent UFO in 1973. So here it is, right here on our planet, things whizzing around, but we were lied to. We were supposed to have bases on the moon by the 1980s, hotels, greenhouses. We were supposed to be headed for Mars by the 90s. And I'm just telling you that the powers that be were told, you're not ready yet, stay away. That's it.
What do you think of that, Robert?
Well, you know,
I've heard it before.
From a cultural developmental perspective, we aren't really much more advanced. In fact, we might even be devolved a little bit from what we were 50 years ago. So if we weren't ready then, I wouldn't think we're ready now. And if there was an alien species stopping us from going, why are they not stopping us now? You know, Elon Musk's development here, innovative space work, is, I think, going to be earth-shattering. It's going to change how space aerospace industry functions. It's going to make this a major industry accomplishing incredible things in the next decades. And if there was an alien species trying to stop us, they would be stopping him, and they're not. That's one thing I'll say off the bat. Secondly, and I've said this many times, if there was aliens and there was any real contact with aliens on Earth now, there's no way that could be kept a secret because there's too many careers that could be made billions of dollars of payoff for making what is probably the most important discovery scientifically in the history of the human race. And so someone tries to keep it a secret, they're not going to succeed. They just will not be able to keep this under wraps. The United States as a society is it's still a free society. It's too chaotic. There's no way government can really shut a discovery like that down. So I doubt seriously there are aliens out there keeping us down. Now, are they UFOs? Are there aliens watching us? I am skeptical. But it's possible, you know, maybe there's an alien species out there that has a prime directive. They're not allowed to interfere with us until we successfully get into space, but they are poking around watching what we're doing. That could be happening. I don't believe it, but it could be happening. But you know what? I don't think, just like prime directive of Star Trek, I don't believe they would have any incentive to stop us from going. If they could get here on big spaceships from other stars, then we're not much of a threat to them. And so why stop us? Let us get into space. If we get into space, we're still not going to be initially much of a threat to them. But at some point, they're going to decide it's time to talk. That's how I see it, at least. Now, the reason we didn't get into space, get to the moon in the last 40 years, is we decided as a nation to copy the Soviet Union's methods. And we all know what happened to the Soviet Union. It doesn't work. A big government, single program, top-down authority does not work. And the only way we're going to actually have a robust space effort is to have many companies competing for profit to accomplish something there. And we're beginning to see that now, and I am very hopeful in the next decade the United States is going to make the rest of the world blush with our achievements.
Probably. Let's hope so, Robert.
I'm always a hopeful person.
Chinese, though, they're coming on strong, aren't they?
Well, you know, it's a government program. It's Soviet style. Their pace is maybe one launch every 2 years. Well, at that speed, I'm not really worried about them as a competitor. Once private enterprise is competing and building things, it will leave them in the dust because that's just too slow a pace. They have a good program. They've got good engineering, but they are government-run programs, centralized, and the only people they compete with is outside their country. And in that situation, it makes it very difficult in the long run for them to compete with us once many companies in the United States are competing against each other for profit. In fact, right now, the Chinese launch capability is the least expensive of any country in the world, and they themselves are beginning to panic because SpaceX will undercut them. And they know that the business will go to SpaceX. It won't go to them because of security concerns. Satellite companies are going to be much better off going to an American company than a Chinese company.
All right. Stay with us for a final round of phone calls with Robert Zimmerman, our space historian, as we started off talking about Hubble's 25th anniversary, a remarkable piece of equipment. I'll tell you that. I'm George Norrie. You can always email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. We shall be back in a moment. Well, we're auctioning off dinner with me at Morton's in Burbank, California. It ends on April 30th. Right now, the bid is $3,000. If you want to up that, simply go to our website, click auction. You'll see it on the front of the homepage. We're benefiting, of course, the American Red Cross. So go ahead and do it just a little bit. And the next bid is $3,250, so take advantage of that. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Bob Zimmerman with us. Bob, as I was talking to some friends today about the anniversary of Hubble, we couldn't help but talk about some of the tragedies that have occurred in our space program with, of course, Apollo 1, the Challenger, the Columbia. We can't have those things stop us, can we?
Absolutely not. Then there's also Apollo 13, where tragedy.
Well, that could have been a disaster.
Because people stood up and said, "Hey, we're going to make it work, even if things go wrong." Things are going to go wrong. There's no way around it. Things are going to go wrong, and we have to face that, and not be afraid of it. I just am always amazed. Before the ocean liner and the metal-hulled ships came along, when it was wooden-frame ships, the clipper ships and previous sailing ship era, it was assumed that 5% of all ships that left dock would never be heard from again. 5%. one in 20 ships. The shuttle had a loss rate of about that, and we go crazy. But the people who came to the United States, North America, and South America to colonize, to settle the New World, all came over, almost all of them came over on sailing ships where they knew there was at best a 1 in 20 chance they would die at sea. And they did that because they recognized that life carries risks and you have to take risks to achieve great things. And I think going into space, it's going to be the same kind of thing. We're going to have things go wrong. And if we don't are not willing to accept that risk, then we will not colonize the solar system as I think the United States is capable of doing. I will say that unequivocally, I'll say this, that others are going to do it. And if we don't, the human race has this imperative. It wishes to expand out beyond the Earth itself. And if the United States doesn't do it, others will. And in fact, even if the United States does it, others will as well anyway, because people all want it, of all nations want that. This is cool, and it's what people want to do, and it's going to happen. And the risk involved is what makes it in itself worth doing.
Sure does. All right, let's take some final calls here, Robert. Let's go to Justin in Austin, Texas. Welcome to the program. Justin, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. I think this is one of the most important shows that I've listened to in a long time because, well, just to start with, the reason why I and all your listeners tune in every night is because you exercise our minds and you it's like you expand our brains like the universe is expanding. You know,
as long as we keep expanding, then that's good.
Okay, so I'm going to tie the coast to coast, just the whole big picture, and I'm going to tie it into what you guys are talking about tonight.
Okay.
We, first of all, the human race is already exploring the universe because our planet, since man has been on Earth,
yes,
our planet's never been in the same place in the universe.
Yes,
twice. It's all new.
Yes.
And why don't we all think about, let's think about Earth as kind of like a cockpit and a Noah's Ark, and the sun and the rest of the planets and the asteroid belt, the whole big picture is a big intergalactic generational starship. I got like an epiphany the other night that every creature, you guys ever noticed that every creature on the planet is just, it's so diverse, and it has everything here.
I know, this planet is just loaded and so teeming.
I think when the ancients were talking about Earth being the center of the universe, it was more of a symbolic meaning for like all that matters. Like the whole universe is here to support what is being saved on this planet.
Well, Robert, what if, and Justin might be onto something, though I don't think we're alone in the universe at all. I think we've been visited by ETs and everything. But what if we are alone in the universe, that theologians, some of them who believe that we are it, that they're correct?
As I hinted at this at the beginning, when you asked me if there's other intelligent life, there has to be a first intelligent species in the universe. We assume that we are not the first. The universe has been around so long that others must have come some and gone, and maybe others are still around. But until we find somebody else, it's possible we are the first. What Justin's talking about, the universe, the Earth itself, is a really interesting thing that I have gathered following planetary research for the last 50 years. It's that the Earth is fundamentally different than every planet we've looked at in the solar system is fundamentally different from all the others. But there's one aspect about Earth that is uniquely different, and that's the fact that you cannot look at almost any spot on the globe and not see it teeming with life on Earth. There's no place. You know, in fact, geologists sometimes have a problem doing geology work because they can't see the surface of the Earth because it's covered with life, trees and plants and jungles. And to do geology, you got to see the ground. Well, we send probes to Mars, and we can see the soil everywhere, the ground everywhere, because there is no life visible. It's not obviously visible. Compared to Earth, it's incredibly barren. You can't find a place on Earth where you won't find it teeming with life. I mean, recent research has found, you know, life forms in the most extreme environments here on Earth. So this makes the Earth an extremely unique object. And then Justin raises another point about it being like a starship, the Earth. We forget how small the atmosphere is relative to the size of the Earth. And we take it for granted that it provides us a place where we can live. But this is a very unusual place compared to the rest of the universe. I mentioned entropy earlier on. The universe tends to run down and become more chaotic. But the Earth is a very organized place. We're taking energy and we're turning it into extremely organized objects, which is counter to entropy. Now, overall, the amount of entropy is increasing. Things are getting more disordered. But within this small planet, things have decided to be very organized. And that's getting into the philosophical aspect of this. There are things not understood, as, you know, there are things beyond our understanding going on, spiritual things about the universe that we cannot quite grasp. And the Earth illustrates that, the wonderness of it,
sure
that that you have this place that is so counter to the barrenness of the rest of the universe that we can see, and yet it teems with life. And that life is so energetic, it is now making the first efforts to leave the Earth and plant life in other barren worlds. And I think that's just wonderful. And it says something about the universe that is spiritual, not just physical and technological.
Well, it's refreshing, Robert, to hear you say that in terms of, you know, that there could be much more than what even science is looking for.
Remember the name of my website, Behind the Black.
Yes, sir.
There's more behind the black than we can conceive. And our effort as a race, as a species, is to try to delve into that black and learn as much as we can about the universe we live in. But the black extends far beyond our reach at this point. And then again, what's a heaven for but should exceed a man's reach, you know? We should strive to find out what's behind that black, but there are things there that we can't quite grasp yet.
All right, let's go back to final calls now. Michelle in Oakland, California, west of the Rockies. Michelle, you are up.
Hi. Oops, I'm sorry.
That's right.
I wanted to call and tell you what my theory about why we're speeding up. And can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. I think that we're speeding up because our universe, the reason our universe is expanding or speeding up is because there is a black hole in the middle of our galaxy.
There is. There's supposed to be.
I don't know that the universe is really speeding up, but our spiral galaxy is because of a black hole. Most spiral galaxies have a black hole in them, and that's why they have the spiral format. And we have about a million years till we go in, and I think that the scientists know it, but they don't say anything, so they don't panic the natives, and this is my theory.
What do you think of that, Robert Zimmerman? People are saying there is a black hole in the middle of our galaxy.
Well, that's pretty much known right now. There is a super that's called the Sagittarius A star. It's about 4 billion times the mass of our sun. We can't see it because it's relatively inactive, but we've been tracking the stars that orbit it close to it now for about 20 years. Those stars are seen through infrared light, which can be seen through the dust clouds that block our view of the center of the galaxy. And by tracking those stars, their orbits, we can calculate the mass that's at the center there, and it's about 4 billion suns. Unlike some black holes in the center of galaxies, our galaxy, our black hole does not seem to be very energetic. When you have a black hole like this, and if any matter falls into it, there's always a burst of energy when that happens. And some black holes are very energetic. They're sucking in matter at great rates, and that produces energetic bursts that can be seen billions of light years away. There are galaxies that appear to be exploding because of that. Quasars can be seen. They're essentially very, very early galaxies in the very early universe. And the reason we can see them is because their central black hole is so energetic. It's sucking in so much matter. Our black hole in the middle of the Milky Way, Sagittarius A star, is generally quiet. It doesn't suck in much matter. And scientists are actually puzzled why that's the case. They're trying to figure that out, and they really don't understand it quite yet at this time.
What's your favorite space movie, Bob?
Forbidden Planet. I'll say that. I usually don't have favorites, but as a kid, that was always one of my favorite films. But I can name dozens of others. The First Men in the Moon from the 60s. Star Wars, the original, as originally produced, was magnificent. The Wrath of Khan's a great film. I can name a lot. I was in the movie business, you know, George, for 20 years.
Yeah, you were.
I know the movie business very well.
I like the original Michael Rennie, The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, it's a wonderful film.
But I love Contact, Wanna Take a Ride. I love that.
I could name many, many films, science fiction films, that are not as well known today, but are worth The Day the Earth Caught Fire. Then, of course, I can't think of names. There's so many that are really worth watching, old science fiction films. When Worlds Collide, it's hard to get nowadays. It's not even available on Netflix. Really a great late 40s film about based on a really good science fiction book by Philip Wiley about a planet colliding with the Earth and destroying it and how people survive in that. And great science fiction.
You remember The Mysterians? That old Japanese film?
Well, now you're getting into the more of the schlocky science fiction.
I love it. I got to have you back on just to talk about space movies.
Oh, I'd love to. That'd
be fun. All right. Let's wrap things up with some final calls here. Let's go to John in Ohio. John, welcome to the show, sir. Go ahead.
Permission to come aboard.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Hey, I got a question for your guest. Man used to believe that the Earth was flat, correct?
Used to be, yep.
Yeah, okay. What about the whole entire galaxy solar system out there, universe, everything? Because like a ripple in a calm pond, it spreads out, but it doesn't spread up. They're always talking about how everything's expanding out. Is it possible that it's all flat as it expands out? You can't go up, you can't go down, but you can go forward, backward, left, or right.
Is it horizontal, Robert?
Well, now you're getting into the call is getting into issues of dimensionality. We see the universe as three dimensional. It's actually four dimensions if you include time as a fourth dimension, as Einstein did. And when the astronomers are looking at the deep space, the ultra deep fields of Hubble, and they are looking at the expansion of the universe, galaxies far away, they are not just looking along a flat plane. They are looking in all directions. So we are seeing it from a three-dimensional perspective. The universe is the analogy that's used best to explain the expansion of the universe is take a balloon, blow it up about halfway, put dots on it, and then blow it up a little bit more. The dots will appear to spread apart from each other. They're not actually moving. What's happening is the space between them, the surface of the balloon, is expanding. That's the expansion of the universe. It's not actually the distance between the galaxies themselves are not flying away from each other. The space between them is expanding. And that's what's going on in our universe as far as we understand it so far. The space itself is expanding. And as you get into vaster scales, the data as we presently have it suggests, it expands faster. Why? I can't answer that question.
Joe is in New York in the Bronx. Hello, Joseph.
Hi, how are you, George?
Good.
I wanted to ask your guest, Robert Zimmerman, about as far as asteroids go, is this the future gold rush? Because the minerals and resources, the potential that it has to be harnessed, is probably incredible. And does Elon Musk and SpaceX have that on their map?
I would say almost certainly. And yes, asteroids are potential. I love your accent, Joseph. It brings me back memories of New York City where I grew up. The asteroids are a potential resource. Their biggest payoff is not going to, I think, be to Earth. But when we have a very viable spacefaring society colonizing the solar system, asteroids are going to them to be to them the most valuable resource. It's not the gold and the minerals, though iron is very a very good resource on asteroids. It's going to be the water, because water is essential for human existence anywhere, and water is harder to get in space. So any place you can find lots of water will be a valuable commodity, and asteroids are one of those places. So are some of the moons of Jupiter, potential asteroid belt. This is why we look for water on the moon. On Mars, I like to talk about the giant volcanoes of Mars. Everyone knows about them. Olympus Mons is the most famous. But Arcia Mons is one of the three that's to the east of Olympus Mons. And they know pretty clearly that there's evidence of glaciers on its western slopes. There's also evidence of caves on its western slopes. And even to this day, routinely, they see vapor clouds, water vapor clouds, above the western slopes of Arcia Mons. And what scientists believe is that a lot of the ice from those glaciers is buried in those caves. Well, that's going to be a prime piece of real estate when we get to Mars, because there you got water, you got caves, you can build civilizations very quickly in that location. So yes, the asteroids, it's on people's minds. We got to learn how to get there first, and that's why SpaceX gets me so excited. They're focused on learning how to build rockets that can get us into space cheaply and be reusable.
Robert, next time you're back, let's talk about some space movies. That should be fun. For Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.